whom this town was so signally honoring, but I had certainly never seen my name spread around so lavishly, and I regretted that I hadn't brought a crowbar and monkey wrench, because many of the signs would have made splendid keepsakes. I particularly fancied having the Bryson City Church of Christ sign beside my front gate in England, and being able to put up different messages every week like, "Repent now, Limeys!" It didn't take long to exhaust the possibilities for diversion in downtown Bryson City, and almost before I realized it, I found myself on the highway out of town, leading towards Cherokee, the next town along the valley. I followed it for a little way, but there was nothing to see except a couple of derelict gas stations and barbecue shacks, and hardly any shoulder to walk on, so the cars shot past only inches away and whipped my clothes into a disconcerting little frenzy. All along the road were billboards and large hand-lettered signs in praise of Christ.
"Get a grip on your life! Praise Jesus! God loves you, America!"
And the rather more enigmatic, "What would happen if you died tomorrow?" Well, I thought there would be no more payments on the freezer for a start. I turned around and went back into town. It was 5:30 in the afternoon. Bryson City was a crypt with sidewalks, and I was at a complete loss. Down a small hill beside the rushing river, I spied an A&P supermarket, which appeared to be open, and I went down there for want of something better to do. I often used to hang out in supermarkets. Robert Swanson and I, when we were about 12, and so obnoxious that it would have been a positive mercy to inject us with something lethal, would often go to the Hinky Dinky supermarket on Ingersoll Avenue in Des Moines during the summer, because it was air-conditioned, and pass the time by doing things I am now ashamed to relate, loosening the bottom of a bag of flour and then watching it pour onto the floor when some unsuspecting woman picked it up, or putting strange items like goldfish food and emetics in people's shopping carts when their backs were turned. I didn't intend to do anything like that in the A&P now, unless, of course, I got really bored, but I thought it would be comforting in this strange place to look at foodstuffs from my youth, and it was. It was almost like visiting old friends. Skippy peanut butter, Pop-Tarts, Welch's grape juice, Sara Lee cakes. I wandered the aisles, murmuring tiny cries of joy at each sighting of an old familiar nutrient. It cheered me up no end. And suddenly I remembered something. Months before, in England, I had noticed an ad for panty shields in the New York Times magazine. These panty shields had dimples on them, and the dimples had a name that was trademarked. This struck me as remarkable. Can you imagine being given the job of thinking up a catchy name for dimples on a panty shield? But I couldn't remember what it was. So now, for no reason other than that I had nothing better to do, I went over and had a look at the A&P's panty shield section. There was a surprising diversity of them. I would never have guessed that the market was so buoyant, or indeed that there were so many panties in Bryson City that needed shielding. I had never paid much attention to this sort of thing before, and it was really kind of interesting. I don't know how long I spent poking about among the various brands and reading the instructions for use, or whether I might even have started talking to myself a little, as I sometimes do when I'm happily occupied. But I suppose it must have been quite some time. In any case, at the very moment that I picked up a packet of new Freedom Thins with funnel dot protection and cried triumphantly, "Aha! There you are, you little buggers!" I turned my head a fraction and noticed that at the far end of the aisle, the manager and two female assistants were watching me. I blushed and clumsily wedged the packet back on the shelves. "Just browsing," I called in an unconvincing voice, hoping I didn't look too dangerous or insane, and made for the exit. I remember reading some weeks before in the Independent, Britain's liveliest quality daily newspaper, order your copy today, that it is still against the law in 20 U.S. states, most of them in the Deep South, for heterosexuals to engage in oral or anal intercourse. I had nothing like that in mind just now, you understand, but I think it indicates that some of these places can be doggedly unenlightened in matters pertaining to sex, and could well have ordinances with respect to the unlawful handling of panty shields. It would just be my luck to pull a 5-10 stretch for some unintended perversion in a place like North Carolina. At all events, I felt fortunate to make it back to my motel without being intercepted by the authorities, and spent the rest of my short stay in Bryson City behaving with the utmost circumspection. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park covers 500,000 acres in North Carolina and Tennessee. I didn't realize it before I went there, but it is the most popular national park in America, attracting 9 million visitors a year, three times as many as any other national park. And even early on a Sunday morning in October, it was crowded. The road between Bryson City and Cherokee at the park's edge was a straggly collection of motels, junky-looking auto repair shops, trailer courts, and barbecue shacks perched on the edge of a glittering stream in a cleft in the mountains. It must have been beautiful once, with dark mountains squeezing in from both sides. But now it was just squalid. Cherokee itself was even worse. It is the biggest Indian reservation in the eastern United States, and it was packed from one end to the other with souvenir stores selling tawdry Indian trinkets, all of them with big signs on their roofs and sides saying,
"Moccasins, Indian jewelry, tomahawks, polished gemstones, crappy items of every description."
Some of the places had a caged brown bear out front, the Cherokee mascot, I gathered. And around each of these was a knot of small boys trying to provoke the animal into a show of ferocity, encouraged from a safe distance by their fathers. At other stores, you could have your photograph taken with a genuine, hungover, flabby-titted Cherokee Indian in war dress for $5. But not many people seemed interested in this, and the model Indians sat slumped in chairs looking as listless as the bears. I don't think I had ever been to a place quite so ugly. And it was jammed with tourists, almost all of them ugly also. Fat people in noisy clothes with cameras dangling on their bellies. Why is it, I wondered idly as I nosed the car through the throngs, that tourists are always fat and dress like morons? Then abruptly, before I could give the question the consideration it deserved, I was out of Cherokee and in the national park, and all the garishness ceased. People don't live in national parks in America as they do in Britain. They are areas of wilderness, often enforced wilderness. The Smoky Mountains were once full of hillbillies who lived in cabins up in the remote hollows, up among the clouds. But they were moved out, and now the park is sterile as far as human activities go. Instead of trying to preserve an ancient way of life, the park authorities eradicated it. So the dispossessed hillbillies moved down to the valley towns at the park's edge and turned them into junkvilles selling crappy little souvenirs. Seems a very strange approach to me. Now a few of the cabins are preserved as museum pieces. There was one at a visitor center just inside the park, which I dutifully stopped to have a look at. It was exactly like the cabins at the Lincoln Village in New Salem in Illinois. I had not realized that it is actually possible to overdose on log cabins. But as I drew near the cabin, I began to feel a sudden onset of brainstem death, and I retreated to the car only after the briefest of looks. The Smoky Mountains themselves were a joy. It was a perfect October morning. The road led steeply up through broad-leaved forests of dappled sunshine, full of paths and streams, and then, higher up, opened out to airy vistas. All along the road through the park there were lookout points where you could pull the car over and go, "Ooh," and "Wow," at the views. They were all named after mountain passes that sounded like condominium developments for yuppies. Pigeon Gap, Cherry Cove, Wolf Mountain, Bear Trap Gap. The air was clear and thin, and the views were vast. The mountains rolled away to a distant horizon, gently shading from rich green to charcoal blue to hazy smoke. It was a sea of trees, like looking out over a landscape from Colombia or Brazil, so virginal was it all. In all the rolling vastness, there was not a single sign of humanity, no towns, no water towers, no plume of smoke from a solitary farmstead. It was just endless silence beneath a bright sky, empty and clear, apart from one distant bluish puff of cumulus, which cast a drifting shadow over a far-off hill. The Oconaluftee Highway across the park is only 30 miles long, but it is so steep and winding that it took me all morning to cross it. By 10 a.m. there was a steady stream of cars in both directions, and free spaces at the lookout points were hard to find. This was my first serious brush with real tourists, retired people with trailer homes heading for Florida, young families taking off-season vacations, honeymooners. There were cars and trailers, campers and motorhomes from thousands of miles away, California, Wyoming, British Columbia. And at every lookout point, people were clustered around their vehicles with the doors and trunks open, feeding from ice coolers and portable fridges. Every few yards, there was a Winnebago or comfort motorhome, massive, self-contained dwellings on wheels that took up three parking spaces and jutted out so far that cars coming in could only barely scrape past. All morning, I had been troubled by a vague sense of something being missing. And then it occurred to me what it was. There were no hikers, such as you would see in England, no people in stout boots and short pants with knee-high tasseled stockings, no little rucksacks full of Marmite sandwiches and flasks of tea, and no platoons of cyclists in skin-tight uniforms and baker's caps laboring breathlessly up the mountainsides, slowing up traffic. What slowed the traffic here were the massive motorhomes lumbering up and down the mountain passes. Some of them amazingly had cars tethered to their rear bumpers like dinghies. I got stuck behind one in the long, sinuous descent down the mountain into Tennessee. It was so wide that it could barely stay within its lane and kept threatening to nudge oncoming cars off into the picturesque void to our left. That, alas, is the way of vacationing nowadays for many people. The whole idea is not to expose yourself to a moment of discomfort or inconvenience. Indeed, not to breathe fresh air, if possible. When the urge to travel seizes you, you pile into your 13-ton tin palace and drive 400 miles across the country, hermetically sealed against the elements, and stop at a campground where you dash to plug into their water supply and electricity so that you don't have to go a single moment without air conditioning or dishwasher and microwave facilities. These things, these recreational vehicles, are like life support systems on wheels. Astronauts go to the moon with less backup. RV people are another breed, and a largely demented one at that. They become obsessed with trying to equip their vehicles with gadgets to deal with every possible contingency. Their lives become ruled by the dread thought that one day they may find themselves in a situation in which they are not entirely self-sufficient. I once went camping for 2 days at Lake Darling in Iowa with a friend whose father, an RV enthusiast, kept trying to press labor-saving devices on us. "I got a great little solar-powered can opener here," he would say. "You want to take that?" "No thanks," we would reply. "We're only going for 2 days." "How about this combination flashlight carving knife? You can run it off the car cigarette lighter if you need to. And it doubles as a flashing siren if you get lost in the wilderness." "No thanks." "Well, at least take the battery-powered microwave."
"Really, we don't want it."
"And how the hell are you going to pop popcorn out there in the middle of nowhere? Have you thought about that?"
A whole industry, in which no doubt the Zwingle Company of New York is actively involved, has grown up to supply this market. You can see these people at campgrounds all over the country, standing around their vehicles comparing gadgets. Methane-powered ice cube makers, portable tennis courts, anti-insect flamethrowers, inflatable lawns. They're strange and dangerous people, and on no account should be approached. At the foot of the mountain, the park ended, and suddenly all was squalor again. I was once more struck by this strange compartmentalization that goes on in America, a belief that no commercial activities must be allowed inside the park, but permitting unrestrained development outside, even though the landscape there may be just as outstanding. America has never quite grasped that you can live in a place without making it ugly, that beauty doesn't have to be confined behind fences, as if a national park were a sort of zoo for nature. The ugliness intensified to fever pitch as I rolled into Gatlinburg, a community that had evidently dedicated itself to the endless quest of trying to redefine the lower limits of bad taste. It is a world capital of tat. It made Cherokee look decorous. There's not much more to it than a single mile-long main street, but it was packed from end to end with the most dazzling profusion of tourist clutter. The Elvis Presley Hall of Fame, Stars Over Gatlinburg Wax Museum, 2 haunted houses, the National Bible Museum, Hillbilly Village, Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, the American Historical Wax Museum, Gatlinburg Space Needle, something called Paradise Island, something else called World of Illusions, the Bonnie Lou and Buster Country Music Show, Carbo's Police Museum, see Walking Tall Sheriff Buford Pusser's death car. Guinness Book of Records Exhibition Center, and, not least, the Earlene Mandrell Hall of Stars Museum and Shopping Mall. In between this galaxy of entertainments were scores of parking lots and noisy, crowded restaurants, junk food stalls, ice cream parlors, and gift shops of the sort that sell wanted posters with your name here, and baseball caps with droll embellishments, like a coil of realistic-looking plastic turd on the brim. Walking in an unhurried fashion up and down the street were more crowds of overweight tourists in boisterous clothes, with cameras bouncing on their bellies, consuming ice creams, cotton candy, and corn dogs, sometimes simultaneously, and wearing baseball caps with plastic turds jauntily attached to the brim. I loved it. When I was growing up, we never got to go to places like Gatlinburg. My father would rather have given himself brain surgery with a Black & Decker drill than spend an hour in such a place. He had just two criteria for gauging the worth of a holiday attraction. Was it educational? And was it free? Gatlinburg was patently neither of these. His idea of holiday heaven was a museum without an admission charge. My dad was the most honest man I ever met, but vacations blinded him to his principles. When I had pimples scattered across my face and stubble on my chin, he was still swearing at ticket booths that I was 8 years old. It was so cheap on vacations that it always surprised me he didn't make us sift in litter bins for our lunch. So Gatlinburg to me was a heady experience. I felt like a priest let loose in Las Vegas with a sock full of quarters. All the noise and glitter, and above all, the possibilities for running through irresponsible sums of money in a short period, made me giddy. I wandered through the crowds and hesitated at the entrance to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. I could sense my father 1,000 miles away beginning to rotate slowly in his grave as I looked at the posters. They told me that inside I would see a man who could hold 3 billiard balls in his mouth at once, a two-headed calf, a human unicorn with a horn protruding from his forehead, and hundreds of other riveting oddities from all over the globe, collected by the tireless Robert Ripley and crated back to Gatlinburg for the edification of discerning tourists such as myself. The admission fee was $5. The pace of my father's rotating quickened as I looked into my wallet, and then sped to a whirling blur as I fished out a $5 bill and guiltily handed it to the unsmiling woman in the ticket booth. What the hell, I thought as I went inside. At least it'll give the old man some exercise. Well, it was superb. I know $5 is a lot of money for a few minutes' diversion. I could just see my father and me standing outside on the sidewalk bickering. My father would say, "No, it's a big jip. For that kind of money, you could buy something that would give you years of value." "Like what? A box of carpet tiles?" I would reply with practiced sarcasm. "Oh, please, Dad. Just this once, don't be cheap. There's a two-headed calf in there."
"No, son, I'm sorry."
"I'll be good forever. I'll take out the garbage every day until I get married." "Dad, there is a guy in there who can hold 3 billiard balls in his mouth at once. There is a human unicorn in there. Dad, we could be throwing away the chance of a lifetime here." But he would not be moved.
"I don't want to hear any more about it. Now let's all get in the car and drive 175 miles to the Molasses Point Historical Battlefield. You'll learn lots of worthwhile things about the little-known American war with Ecuador of 1802, and it won't cost me a penny."
So I went through the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, and I savored every artifact and tasteless oddity. It was outstanding. I mean, honestly, where else are you going to see a replica of Columbus's flagship, the Santa Maria, made entirely of chicken bones? And how can you possibly put a price on seeing an 8-foot-long model of the Circus Maximus constructed of sugar cubes? Or the death mask of John Dillinger? Or a room made entirely of matchsticks by one Reg Polland of Manchester, England?
Well done, Reg. Britain is proud of you.
We are talking lasting memories here. I was pleased to note that England was further represented by, of all things, a chimney pot circa 1940. Believe it or not, it was all wonderful. Clean, nicely presented, sometimes even believable. And I spent a happy hour there. Afterwards, feeling highly content, I purchased an ice cream cone the size of a baby's head and wandered with it through the crowds of people in the afternoon sunshine. I went into a series of gift shops and tried on baseball caps with plastic turds on the brim. But the cheapest one I saw was $7.99, and I decided, out of deference to my father, that that would be just too much extravagance for one afternoon. If it came to it, I could always make my own, I thought, as I returned to the car and headed for the dangerous hills of Appalachia. Chapter 10. In 1587, a group of 115 English settlers, men, women, and children, sailed from Plymouth to set up the first colony in the New World, on Roanoke Island, off what is now North Carolina. Shortly after they arrived, a child named Virginia Dare was born, and thus became the first white person to arrive in America head first. 2 years later, a second expedition set off from England to see how the settlers were getting on, and to bring them their mail and tell them that the repairman from British Telecom had finally shown up, and that sort of thing. But when the relief party arrived, they found the settlement deserted. There was no message of where the settlers had gone, nor any sign of a struggle, but just one word mysteriously scratched on a wall. Croatoan. This was the name of a nearby island where the Indians were known to be friendly, but a trip to the island showed that the settlers had never arrived there. So where did they go? Did they leave voluntarily, or were they spirited off by Indians? This has long been one of the great mysteries of the colonial period. I bring this up here because one theory is that the settlers pushed inland, up into the hills of Appalachia, and settled there. No one knows why they might have done this, but 50 years later, when European explorers arrived in Tennessee, the Cherokee Indians told them that there was a group of pale people living in the hills already, people who wore clothes and had long beards. These people, according to a contemporary account, had a bell which they rang before they ate their meals and had a strange habit of bowing their heads and saying something in a low voice before they ate. No one ever found this mysterious community, but in a remote and neglected corner of the Appalachians, high up in the Clinch Mountains above the town of Sneedville in northeastern Tennessee, there still live some curious people called Melungeons, who have been there for as long as anyone can remember. The Melungeons, no one knows where the name comes from, have most of the characteristics of Europeans: blue eyes, fair hair, lanky build, but a dark, almost negroid skin coloring that is distinctly non-European. They have English family names: Brogan, Collins, Mullins, but no one, including the Melungeons themselves, has any idea of where they come from or what their early history might have been. They are as much of a mystery as the lost settlers of Roanoke Island. Indeed, it has been suggested that they may be the lost settlers of Roanoke. Peter Dunn, a colleague at the Independent in London, put me on to the Melungeon story when he heard that I was going to that part of the world, and kindly dug out an article he had done for the Sunday Times magazine some years before. This was illustrated with remarkable photographs of Melungeons. It is impossible to describe them, except to say that they were simply white people with black skin. Their appearance was, to say the least, striking. For this reason, they have long been outcasts in their own county, consigned to shacks in the hills in an area called Snake Hollow. In Hancock County, Melungeon is equivalent to nigger. The valley people, who are themselves generally poor and backward, regard the Melungeons as something strange and shameful, and the Melungeons, as a consequence, keep to themselves, coming down from the mountains only at widely spaced intervals to buy provisions. They don't like outsiders. Neither do the valley people. Peter Dunn told me that he and the photographer who accompanied him were given a reception that ranged from mild hostility to outright intimidation. It was an uncomfortable assignment. A few months later, a reporter from Time magazine was actually shot near Sneedville for asking too many questions. So you can perhaps imagine the sense of foreboding that seeped over me as I drove up Tennessee Highway 31 through a forgotten landscape of poor and scattered tobacco farms, through the valley of the twisting Clinch River en route to Sneedville. This was the seventh poorest county in the nation, and it looked it. Litter was adrift in the ditches, and most of the farmhouses were small and unadorned. In every driveway there stood a pickup truck with a gun rack in the back window, and where there were people in the yards, they stopped what they were doing to watch me as I passed. It was late afternoon, nearly dusk, when I reached Sneedville. Outside the Hancock County Courthouse, a group of teenagers were perched on the fronts of pickup trucks talking to each other, and they, too, stared at me as I passed.
Sneedville is so far from anywhere, such an improbable destination, that a stranger's car attracts notice. There wasn't much to the town. The courthouse, a Baptist church, some box houses, a gas station. The gas station was still open, so I pulled in. I didn't particularly need gas, but I wasn't sure when I would find another station. The guy who came out to pump the gas had an abundance of fleshy warts, a veritable crop, scattered across his face like button mushrooms. He looked like a genetic experiment that had gone horribly wrong. He didn't speak except to establish what kind of gas I wanted, and he didn't remark on the fact that I was from out of state. This was the first time on the trip that a gas station attendant hadn't said in an engaging manner, "You're a long way from home, aren't you?" or "What brings you all the way here from Iowa?" or something like that. I always told them that I was on my way east to have vital heart surgery in the hope that they would give me extra green stamps. I was very probably the first person from out of state this man had seen all year, yet he appeared resolutely uninterested in what I was doing there. It was odd. I said to him, blurted really, "Excuse me, but didn't I read somewhere that some people called Melungeons live around here somewhere?" He didn't answer. He just watched the pump counter spin. I thought he hadn't heard me, so I said, "I say, excuse me, but didn't I hear that some people..." "Don't know," he said abruptly without looking at me. Then he looked at me. "Don't know nothing about that. You want your oil checked?" I hesitated, surprised by the question.
No, thank you."
"That's $11.
He took my money without thanks and went back inside. I was fairly dumbfounded. I don't know quite why. Through the window I could see him pick up his telephone and make a call. He looked at me as he did it. Suddenly I felt alarmed. What if he was calling the police to tell him to come out and shoot me? I laid a small patch of rubber on his driveway as I departed, something you don't often see achieved with a Chevette, and made the pistons sing as I floored the accelerator and hurtled out of town at a breakneck 27 miles an hour. But a mile or so later I slowed down. Partly this was because I was going up an almost vertical hill and the car wouldn't go any faster. For one breathless moment I thought it might actually start rolling backwards, and partly because I told myself not to be so jumpy. The guy was probably just calling his wife to remind her to buy more wart lotion. Even if he was calling the police to report an outsider asking impertinent questions, what could they do to me? It was a free country. I hadn't broken any laws. I had asked an innocent question and asked it politely. How could anyone take offense at that? Clearly, I was being silly to feel any sense of menace. Even so, I found myself glancing frequently into the rearview mirror and half expecting to see the hill behind me crawling with flashing squad cars and posses of volunteer vigilantes and pickup trucks coming after me. Judiciously, I stepped up my speed from 11 to 13 miles an hour. High up the hill, I began to encounter shacks set back in clearings in the woods and peered at them in the hope of glimpsing a Melungeon or two, but the few people I saw were white. They stared at me with a strange look of surprise as I lumbered past, the way you might stare at a man riding an ostrich, and generally made no response to my cheerful wave, though one or two did reply with an automatic and economic wave of their own, a raised hand and a twitch of fingers. This was real hillbilly country. Many of the shacks looked like something out of Little Abner, with sagging porches and tilting chimneys. Some were abandoned. Many appeared to have been handmade, with rambling extensions that had clearly been fashioned from scraps of plundered wood. People in these hills still made moonshine, or stump liquor, as they call it. But the big business these days is marijuana, believe it or not. I read somewhere that whole mountain villages band together and can make $100,000 a month from a couple of acres planted in some remote and lofty hollow. More than the Melungeons, that is an excellent reason not to be a stranger asking questions in the area. Although I was clearly climbing high up into the mountains, the woods all around were so dense that I had no views. But at the summit the trees parted like curtains to provide a spectacular outlook over the valley on the other side. It was like coming over the top of the earth, like the view from an airplane. Steep, green, wooded hills with alpine meadows clinging to their sides stretched away for as far as the eye could see, until at last they were consumed by a distant and colorful sunset. Before me, a sinuous road led steeply down to a valley of rolling farms, spread out along a lazy river. It was as perfect a setting as I had ever seen. I drove through the soft light of dusk, absorbed by the beauty. And the thing was, every house along the roadside was a shack. This was the heart of Appalachia, the most notoriously impoverished region of America, and it was just inexpressibly beautiful. It was strange that the urban professionals from the cities of the eastern seaboard, only a couple of hours' drive to the east, hadn't colonized an area of such arresting beauty, filling the dales with rustic-y weekend cottages, country clubs, and fancy restaurants. It was strange, too, to see white people living in poverty. In America, to be white and impoverished really takes some doing. Of course, this was American poverty. This was white people's poverty, which isn't like poverty elsewhere. It isn't even like the poverty in Tuskegee. It has been suggested, with more than a touch of cynicism, that when Lyndon Johnson launched his great war on poverty in 1964, the focus was placed on Appalachia not because it was so destitute, but because it was so white. A little publicized survey at the time showed that 40% of the poorest people in the region owned a car, and a third of those had been bought new. In 1964, my future father-in-law in England was, like most people there, years away from owning his first car, and even now he's never owned a new one. Yet no one ever called him destitute, or sent him a free sack of flour and some knitting wool at Christmas. Still, I can't deny that by American standards, the scattered shacks around me were decidedly modest. They had no satellite dishes in the yard, no Weber barbecues, no station wagons standing in the drive. And I dare say they had no microwaves in the kitchen, poor devils. And by American standards, that is pretty damn deprived. Chapter 11. I drove through a landscape of gumdrop hills, rolling roads, neat farms. The sky was full of those big fluffy clouds you always see in nautical paintings, and the towns had curious and interesting names: Snowflake, Fancy Gap, Horse Pasture, Meadows of Dan, Charity. Virginia went on and on. It never seemed to end. The state is nearly 400 miles across, but the twisting road must have added at least 100 miles to that. In any case, every time I looked at the map, I seemed to have moved a remarkably tiny distance. From time to time, I would pass a sign that said, "Historical marker ahead," but I didn't stop. There are thousands of historical markers all over America, and they are always dull. I know this for a fact, because my father stopped at every one of them. He would pull the car up to them and read them aloud to us, even when we asked him not to. They would say something like, "Singing Trees, Sacred Burial Site. For centuries, this land, known as the Valley of the Singing Trees, was a sacred burial site for the Blackbutt Indians. In recognition of this, the U.S. government gave the land to the tribe in perpetuity in 1880. However, in 1882, oil was discovered beneath the Singing Trees, and, after a series of skirmishes in which 27,413 Blackbutts perished, the tribe was relocated to a reservation at Cyanide Springs, New Mexico." What am I saying? They were never as good as that. Usually they would commemorate something palpably obscure and uninteresting: the site of the first Bible college in western Tennessee, the birthplace of the inventor of the moist towelette, the home of the author of the Kansas State Song. You knew, before you got there, that they were going to be boring. Because if they had been even remotely interesting, somebody would have set up a hamburger stand and sold souvenirs. But Dad thrived on them and would never fail to be impressed. After reading them to us, he would say in an admiring tone, "Well, I'll be darned." And then, without fail, would pull back onto the highway into the path of an oncoming truck, which would honk furiously and shed part of its load as it swerved past. "Yes, that was really very interesting," he would add reflectively, unaware that he had just about killed us all. I was heading for the Booker T. Washington National Monument, a restored plantation near Roanoke, where Booker T. Washington grew up. He was a remarkable man. A freed slave, he taught himself to read and write, secured an education, and eventually founded the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, the first college in America for blacks. Then, as if that were not achievement enough, he finished his career as a soul musician, churning out a series of hits in the 1960s on the Stax record label with the backup group the MGs. As I say, a remarkable man. My plan was to visit his monument and then zip over to Monticello for a leisurely look around Thomas Jefferson's home. But it was not to be. Just beyond Patrick Springs, I spied a side road leading to a place called Crits, which I calculated, with a glance at the map, could cut 30 miles off my driving distance. Impulsively, I hauled the car around the corner, making the noise of squealing tires as I went. I had to make the noise myself, because the Chevette couldn't manage it, though it did shoot out some blue smoke. I should have known better. My first rule of travel is never to go to a place that sounds like a medical condition, and Crits clearly was an incurable disease involving flaking skin. The upshot is that I got hopelessly lost. The road, once I lost sight of the highway, broke up into a network of unsignposted lanes hemmed in by tall grass. I drove for ages, with that kind of glowering, insane resolve that you get when you are lost and become convinced that if you just keep moving, you will eventually end up where you want to be. I kept coming to towns that weren't on my map. Sanville, Pleasantville, Preston. These weren't two-shack places. They were proper towns with schools, gas stations, lots of houses. I felt as if I should call the newspaper in Roanoke and inform the editor that I'd found a lost county. Eventually, as I passed through Sanville for the third time, I decided I would have to ask directions. I stopped an old guy taking his dog out to splash urine around the neighborhood and asked him the way to Crits. Without batting an eyelid, he launched into a set of instructions of the most breathtaking complexity. He must have talked for 5 minutes. It sounded like a description of Lewis and Clark's journey through the wilderness. I couldn't follow it at all, but when he paused and said, "You with me so far?" I lied and said I was. "Okay, well, that takes you to Preston," he went on. "From there you follow the old drover's road due east out of town till you come to the McGregor Place. You can tell it's the McGregor Place because there's a sign out front saying, 'The McGregor Place.' About 100 yards further on, there's a road going off to the left with a sign for Crits. But whatever you do, don't go down there because the bridge is out, and you'll plunge straight into Dead Man's Creek." And on he went like that for many minutes. When at last he finished, I thanked him, and drove off without conviction in the general direction of his last gesture. Within 200 yards I'd come to a T-junction and didn't have a clue which way to go. I went right. 10 minutes later, to the surprise of both of us, I was driving past the old guy and his ever-urinating dog again. Out of the corner of my eye I could see him gesturing excitedly, shouting at me that I'd gone the wrong way. But as this was already abundantly evident to me, I ignored his hopping around and went left at the junction. This didn't get me any nearer Crits, but it did provide me with a new set of dead ends and roads to nowhere. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 hours after I set off for Crits, I blundered back onto Highway 58. I was 150 feet further down the road than I had been when I left it. Sourly, I pulled back onto the highway and drove for many long hours in silence. It was too late to go to the Booker T. Washington National Monument or to Monticello, even assuming I could summon the intelligence to find them. The day had been a complete washout. I had had no lunch, no life-giving infusions of coffee. It had been a day without pleasure or reward. I got a room in a motel in Fredericksburg, ate at a pancake house of ineffable crappiness, and retired to my room in a dim frame of mind. In the morning, I drove to Colonial Williamsburg, a restored historic village near the coast. It is one of the most popular tourist attractions in the East, and even though it was early on a Tuesday morning in October when I arrived, the car parks were already filling up. I parked and joined a stream of people following the signs to the visitor's center. Inside, it was cool and dark. Near the door was a scale model of the village in a glass case. Oddly, there was no "You Are Here" arrow to help you get oriented. Indeed, the visitor center wasn't even shown. There was no way of telling where the village was in relation to where you were now. That seemed strange to me, and I became suspicious. I stood back and watched the crowds. Gradually it became clear to me that the whole thing was a masterpiece of crowd management. Everything was contrived to leave you with the impression that the only way into Williamsburg was to buy a ticket, pass through a door ominously marked "Processing," and then climb aboard a shuttle bus which would whisk you off to the historic site, presumably some distance away. Unless, like me, you pulled out of the river of people, you found yourself standing at the ticket counter making an instant decision on which of three kinds of ticket to buy. A Patriot's Pass for $24.50, a Royal Governor's Pass for $20, or a basic admission ticket for $15.50, each allowing entrance to a different number of restored buildings. Most visitors found themselves parted from a lot of money and standing in the line to the processing doorway before they knew what had hit them. I hate the way these places let you get all the way there before disclosing just how steep and confiscatory the admission price is. They should be required to put up roadside signs saying, 3 miles to Colonial Williamsburg, get your checkbooks ready. Or 1 mile to Colonial Williamsburg, it's pretty good, but real expensive. I felt that irritation bordering on wild hate that I generally experience when money is being tugged out of me through my nostrils. I mean, honestly, $24.50 just to walk around a restored village for a couple of hours? I gave silent thanks that I had ditched the wife and kids at Manchester Airport. A day out here with a family could cost almost $75, and that's before paying for ice creams and soft drinks and sweatshirts saying, "Boy, were we screwed at Colonial Williamsburg." There was something wrong with the whole setup, something deeply fishy about the way it worked. I had lived in America long enough to know that if the only way into Williamsburg was to buy a ticket, there would be an enormous sign on the wall saying, "You must have a ticket. Don't even think about trying to get in without one." But there wasn't any such sign. I went outside, back out into the bright sunshine, and watched where the shuttle buses were going. They went down the driveway, joined a dual carriageway, and disappeared around a bend. I crossed the dual carriageway, dodging the traffic, and followed a path through some woods. In a few seconds, I was in the village. It was as simple as that. I didn't have to pay a penny. Nearby, the shuttle buses were unloading ticket holders. They had had a ride of roughly 200 yards and were about to discover that what their tickets entitled them to was to join long, ill-humored lines of other ticket holders standing outside each restored historic building, sweating in silence and shuffling forward at a rate of one step every 3 minutes. I don't think I had ever seen quite so many people failing to enjoy themselves. The glacial lines put me in mind of Disney World, which was not altogether inappropriate since Williamsburg is really a sort of Disney World of American history. All the ticket takers and street sweepers and information givers were dressed in period costumes, the women in big aprons and muffin hats, the men in tri-cornered hats and breeches. The whole idea was to give history a happy gloss and make you think that spinning your own wool and dipping your own candles must have been bags of fun. I half expected to see Goofy and Donald Duck come waddling along dressed as soldiers in the Colonial Army. The first house I came to had a sign saying, "Dr. Mackenzie's Apothecary." The door was open, so I went inside, expecting to see 18th-century apothecary items. But it was just a gift shop, selling twee reproductions at outrageous prices. Brass candle snifters at $28, reproduction apothecary jars at $35, that sort of thing. I fled back outside, wanting to stick my head in ye old village puking trough. But then, slowly and strangely, the place began to grow on me. As I strolled up Duke of Gloucester Street, I underwent a surprising transformation. Slowly, I found that I was becoming captivated by it all. Williamsburg is big, 173 acres, and the size of it alone is impressive. There are literally dozens of restored houses and shops. More than that, it really is quite lovely, particularly on a sunny morning in October with a mild wind wandering through the ash and beech trees. I ambled along the leafy lanes and broad greens. Every house was exquisite, every cobbled lane inviting, every tavern and vine-clad shoppy remorselessly adrip with picturesque charm. It is impossible, even for a flinty-hearted jerk-off such as your narrator, not to be won over. However dubious Williamsburg may be as a historical document, and it is plenty dubious, it is at least a model town. It makes you realize what an immeasurably nice place much of America could be, if only people possessed the same instinct for preservation as they do in Europe. You would think the millions of people who come to Williamsburg every year would say to each other, "Gosh, Bobby, this place is beautiful. Let's go home to Smellville and plant lots of trees and preserve all the fine old buildings." But in fact, that never occurs to them. They just go back and build more parking lots and pizza huts. A lot of Williamsburg isn't as old as they like you to think it is. The town was the capital of colonial Virginia for 80 years, from 1699 to 1780. But when the capital was moved to Richmond, Williamsburg fell into decline. In the 1920s, John D. Rockefeller developed a passion for the place and began pouring money into its restoration, $90 million so far. The problem now is that you never quite know what's genuine and what's fanciful. Take the governor's palace. It looks to be very old, and, as I say, no one discourages you from believing that it is, but in fact it was only built in 1933. The original building burned down in 1781 and by 1930 had been gone for so long that nobody knew what it had looked like. It was only because somebody found a drawing of it in the Bodleian Library in Oxford that they were able to make a reasonable stab at reproducing it. But it isn't old, and it may not even be all that accurate. Everywhere you turn, you are confronted exasperatingly with bogus touches. At the Bruton Parish Church, the gravestones were clearly faked, or at least the engravings had been reground. Rockefeller or someone else in authority had obviously been disappointed to discover that after a couple of centuries in the open air, gravestones become illegible. So now the inscriptions are as fresh and deep-grooved as if they'd been cut only last week, which they may well have been. You find yourself constantly wondering whether you're looking at genuine history or some Disney-esque embellishment. Was there really a Severinus Dufray, and would he have had a sign outside his house saying genteel tailoring? Possibly. Would Dr. Mackenzie have a note in florid lettering outside his dispensary announcing, "Dr. Mackenzie begs leave to inform the public he has just received a large quantity of fine goods, viz., tea, coffee, fine soap, tobacco, etc., to be sold here at his shop"? Who can say? Thomas Jefferson, a man of some obvious sensitivity, disliked Williamsburg and thought it ugly. This is something else they don't tell you. He called the college and hospital rude, misshapen piles, and the governor's palace not handsome. He can't have been describing the same place, because the Williamsburg of today is relentlessly attractive, and for that reason, I liked it. I drove on to Mount Vernon, George Washington's home for most of his life. Washington deserves his fame. What he did in running the colonial army was risky and audacious, not to say skillful. People tend to forget that the Revolutionary War dragged on for 8 years, and that Washington often didn't get a whole lot of support. Out of a populace of 5.5 million, Washington sometimes had as few as 5,000 soldiers in his army, one soldier for every 1,100 people. When you see what a tranquil and handsome place Mount Vernon is, and what an easy and agreeable life he led there, you wonder why he bothered. But that's the appealing thing about Washington. He is such an enigma. We don't even know for sure what he looked like. Almost all the portraits of him were done by, or copied from the works of, Charles Wilson Peale. Peale painted 60 portraits of Washington, but unfortunately, he wasn't very hot at faces. In fact, according to Samuel Eliot Morison, Peale's pictures of Washington, Lafayette, and John Paul Jones all looked to be more or less the same person. Mount Vernon was everything Williamsburg should have been and was not. Genuine, interesting, instructive. For well over a century it has been maintained by the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, and what a lucky thing it is we have them. Amazingly, when the house was put up for sale in 1853, neither the federal government nor the state of Virginia was prepared to buy it for the nation. So a group of dedicated women hastily formed the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, raised the money to buy the house and 200 acres of grounds, and then set about restoring it to precisely as it was in Washington's day, right down to the correct pigments of paint and patterns of wallpaper. Thank God John D. Rockefeller didn't get hold of it. Today, the association continues to run it with a dedication and skill that should be models to preservation groups everywhere, but, alas, are not. 14 rooms are open to the public, and in each, a volunteer provides an interesting and well-informed commentary, and is sufficiently clued up to answer almost any question on how the room was used and decorated. The house was very much Washington's creation. He was involved in the daintiest questions of decor, even when he was away on military campaigns. It was strangely pleasing to imagine him at Valley Forge with his troops dropping dead of cold and hunger, agonizing over the purchase of lace ruffs and tea cozies,
What a great guy. What a hero.
Chapter 12. I spent the night on the outskirts of Alexandria, and in the morning drove into Washington. I remembered Washington from my childhood as hot and dirty and full of the din of jackhammers. It had that special kind of grimy summer heat you used to get in big cities in America before air conditioning came along. People spent every waking moment trying to alleviate it, wiping their necks with capacious handkerchiefs, swallowing cold glasses of lemonade, lingering by open refrigerators, sitting listlessly before electric fans. Even at night, there was no relief. It was tolerable enough outside, where you might catch a puff of breeze, but indoors, the heat never dissipated. It just sat, thick and stifling. It was like being inside a vacuum cleaner bag. I can remember lying awake in a hotel in downtown Washington, listening to the sounds of an August night wash in through the open window. Sirens, car horns, the thrum of neon from the hotel sign, the swish of traffic, people laughing, people yelling, people being shot. We once saw a guy who had been shot, one sultry August night when we were out for a late snack after watching the Washington Senators beat the New York Yankees 4-3 at Griffith Stadium. He was a black man, and he was lying among a crowd of legs in what appeared to me at the time to be a pool of oil, but which was, of course, the blood that was draining out of the hole in his head. My parents hustled us past and told us not to look, but we did, of course. Things like that didn't happen in Des Moines, so we gaped extensively. I had only ever seen murders on TV programs like Gunsmoke and Dragnet. I thought it was something they did just to keep the story moving. It had never occurred to me that shooting someone was an option available in the real world. It seemed such a strange thing to do, to stop someone's life just because you found him in some way disagreeable. I imagined my fourth-grade teacher, Miss Beetlebaum, who had hair on her upper lip and evil in her heart, lying on the floor beside her desk, stilled forever, while I stood over her with a smoking gun in my hand. It was an interesting concept. It made you think. At the diner where we went for our snack, there was yet another curious thing that made me think. White people like us would come in and take seats at the counter, but black people would place an order and then stand against the wall. When their food was ready, it would be handed to them in a paper bag, and they would take it home or out to their car. My father explained to us that Negroes weren't allowed to sit at luncheon counters in Washington. It wasn't against the law, exactly, but they didn't do it because Washington was enough of a southern city that they just didn't dare. That seemed strange, too, and it made me even more reflective. Afterwards, lying awake in the hot hotel room, listening to the restless city, I tried to understand the adult world and could not. I had always thought that once you grew up, you could do anything you wanted, stay up all night or eat ice cream straight out of the container. But now, on this one important evening of my life, I had discovered that if you didn't measure up in some critical way, people might shoot you in the head or make you take your food out to the car. I sat up on one elbow and asked my dad if there were places where Negroes ran lunch counters and made white people stand against the wall. My dad regarded me over the top of a book and said he didn't think so. I asked him what would happen if a Negro tried to sit at a luncheon counter, even though he wasn't supposed to. What would they do to him? My dad said he didn't know, and told me I should go to sleep and not worry about such things. I lay down and thought about it for a while and supposed that they would shoot him in the head. Then I rolled over and tried to sleep, but I couldn't, partly because it was so hot and I was confused, and partly because earlier in the evening my brother had told me that he was going to come over to my bed when I was asleep and wipe boogers on my face because I hadn't given him a bit of my frosted malt at the ball game. And I was frankly unsettled by the prospect, even though he seemed to be sleeping soundly now. The world has changed a lot since those days, of course. Now, if you lie awake in a hotel room at night, you don't hear the city anymore. All you hear is the white sound of your air conditioner. You could be in a jet over the Pacific or in a bathysphere beneath the sea for all you hear. Everywhere you go is air-conditioned, so the air is always as cool and clean as a freshly laundered shirt. People don't wipe their necks much anymore, or drink sweating glasses of lemonade, or lay their bare arms gratefully on cool marble soda fountains, because nowadays summer heat is something out there, something experienced only briefly when you sprint from your parking lot to your office, or from your office to the luncheon counter down the block. Nowadays, black people sit at luncheon counters, so it's not as easy to get a seat, but it's more fair. And no one goes to Washington Senators games anymore because the Washington Senators no longer exist. In 1972, the owner moved the team to Texas because he could make more money there. Alas. But perhaps the most important change, at least as far as I am concerned, is that my brother no longer threatens to wipe boogers on me when I annoy him. Washington feels like a small city. Its metropolitan population is 3 million, which makes it the 7th largest in America. And if you add Baltimore right next door, it rises to over 5 million. But the city itself is quite small, with a population of just 637,000. Less than Indianapolis or San Antonio. You feel as if you're in some agreeable provincial city. But then you turn a corner and come up against the headquarters of the FBI, or the World Bank, or the IMF, and you realize what an immensely important place it is. The most startling of all these surprises is the White House. There you are, shuffling along downtown, looking in department store windows, browsing at cravats and negligees, and you turn a corner, and there it is. The White House, right in the middle of the downtown. So handy for shopping, I thought. It's smaller than you expect. Everybody says that. Across the street, there's a permanent settlement of disaffected people and crazies living in cardboard boxes, protesting at the Central Intelligence Agency controlling their thoughts from outer space. Well, wouldn't you? There was also a guy panhandling for quarters. Can you believe that? Right there in our nation's capital, right where Nancy Reagan could see him from her bedroom window. Washington's most fetching feature is the Mall, a broad, grassy strip of parkland which stretches for a mile or so from the Capitol Building at the eastern end to the Lincoln Memorial at the western side, overlooking the Potomac. The dominant landmark is the Washington Monument. Slender and white, shaped like a pencil, it rises 555 feet above the park. It is one of the simplest and yet handsomest structures I know, and all the more impressive when you consider that its massive stones had to be brought from the Nile Delta on wooden rollers by Sumerian slaves. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the Great Pyramids at Giza. Anyway, it's a real feat of engineering, and very pleasing to look at. I had hoped to go up it, but there was a long line of people, mostly restive schoolchildren, snaked around the base and some distance into the park, all waiting to squeeze into an elevator about the size of a telephone booth. So I headed east, in the direction of Capitol Hill, which isn't really much of a hill at all. Scattered around the mall's eastern end are the various museums of the Smithsonian Institution, the Museum of American History, the Museum of Natural History, the Air and Space Museum, and so on. The Smithsonian, which incidentally was donated to America by an Englishman who had never been there, used to be all in one building, but they kept splitting off sections of it and putting them in new buildings all over town. Now there are 14 Smithsonian museums. The biggest ones are arrayed around the mall. The others are mostly scattered around the city. Partly they had to do this because they get so much stuff every year, about 1 million items. In 1986, just to give you some idea, the Smithsonian's acquisitions included 10,000 moths and butterflies from Scandinavia, the entire archives of the Panama Canal Zone Postal Service, part of the old Brooklyn Bridge, and a MiG-25 jet fighter. All of this used to be kept in a wonderful old Gothic brick building on the mall called the Castle, but now the castle is just used for administration and to show an introductory film. I strolled down towards the castle now. The park was full of joggers. I found this a little worrying. I kept thinking, shouldn't they be running the country, or at least destabilizing some Central American government? I mean to say, don't you usually have something more important to do at 10:30 on a Wednesday morning than pull on a pair of Reeboks and go sprinting around for 45 minutes? At the castle, I found the entrance area blocked with wooden trestles and lengths of rope. American and Japanese security men in dark suits were standing around. They all looked as if they spent a lot of time jogging. Some of them had headphones on and were talking into radios. Others had dogs on long leashes or mirrors on poles and were checking out cars parked along Jefferson Drive in front of the building. I went up to one of the American security men and asked him who was coming, but he said he wasn't allowed to tell me. I thought this was bizarre. Here I was in a country where Thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, I could find out how many suppositories Ronald Reagan's doctor had prescribed for him in 1986.
1,472.
But I couldn't be told which foreign dignitary would shortly be making a public appearance on the steps of a national institution. The lady next to me said,
"It's Nakasone, president of Japan."
"Oh, really?" I replied, always ready to see a celebrity. I asked the security man when he would be arriving.
"I'm not allowed to tell you that either, sir," he said, and passed on.
I stood with the crowd for a while and waited for Mr. Nakasone to come along, and then I thought, why am I standing here? I tried to think of anyone I knew who would be impressed to hear that I had seen with my own eyes the Prime Minister of Japan. I imagined myself saying to my children, "Hey, kids, guess who I saw in Washington? Yasuhiro Nakasone!" And being met with silence. So I walked onto the National Air and Space Museum, which was more interesting. But not nearly as interesting as it ought to be, if you ask me. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the Smithsonian was the castle. Everything was crammed into this one wonderfully dark and musty old building. It was like the nation's attic. And like an attic, it was gloriously random. Over here was the shirt Lincoln was wearing when he was shot, with a brown bloodstain above the heart. Over there was a diorama showing a Navajo family fixing dinner. Up above you, hanging from the gloomy rafters, were the Spirit of St. Louis and the Wright brothers' first plane. You didn't know where to look next or what you would find.